Looks like I'm going to make a pot and preach about it. But I've done that before here. So we're going to wait. And after I preach, then I'm going to make a pot while the worship team is doing and give you a chance to meditate about being made into a servant vessel. Jesus said about himself, he said that he didn't come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. And so we want to sort of look at that, what it means to, okay, don't worry. I saw it. I would only trip and fall and break something, this whole idea of service and of being a servant vessel and allowing God to use us, how he wants to use us. There's a quote by John Locke, who's a English scholar, and he talks about us being God's property and not being used for our own purposes, but for God's, that we belong to him. And God, part of the Christian life is learning how to give God permission to use us how he wants to use us and not how we want to be used. A lot of us have these goals and we've got these desires. And a few years ago, I had a friend who I've known for many years from South Africa. He's a counselor, does a lot of ministry, comes up and does a series at our discipleship training school in Namibia called the Plumb Line, and it's a great program, and it really reaches people. People get free from a lot of bondages, and we go through a whole week of letting God's plumb line be the standard for our lives, and they go and they repent about things, and we pray for them for healing, and people really get set free. And so he's got a really great ministry, and he came and he asked Suzanne and I, we had him over for tea because we always like to have him over, and he said, well, are you fulfilled in what you're doing? And I thought about it, and I thought, gee, I don't know. I haven't thought about that in years. You know, it was this funny question. It was like, oh, am I supposed to be fulfilled? I guess so. But that's really not where I'm at anymore. I think I left that one a long way back. Like, and when we first went to Namibia, and so I want to share a little bit about my testimony this morning about what God's done in my life and how he's changed me by being on the mission field. And being involved in a country where people are real poor. Now, I got saved in Afghanistan, in Kabul. Okay? It's about as far away from Jesus as you can get. You know, I mean, where I grew up and, you know, the church and America and Christianity. I mean, Christianity was at that point illegal basically in Afghanistan. And it was the first time in my life. I grew up in Beverly Hills, California. I did not grow up poor. Okay, I didn't grow up rich, like celebrity rich either, but I didn't grow up poor. And for the first time in my life, being in Afghanistan, I saw really poor people. I remember when we crossed the border coming from the west, we had hitchhiked a ride with a guy in a VW microbus, and he was going to buy furniture, some French guy. Probably furniture filled with drugs and the stuff to take back to Paris to sell, but he didn't tell us that, so I'm assuming he bought furniture. And we got into Herat, and Herat is a city of mud. You're coming in from the west through Iran, and you get to the border. And I remember sleeping outside that night or sitting up waiting. I forget, we got in before the border opened, and we were sitting there watching the stars. And it was just this amazing sky with this crescent moon. It seemed very appropriate going into a Muslim country. And I remember getting into Herat, and the whole city's made out of mud. least it was then. I don't think it's changed a lot since it hadn't changed much in 4,000 years. I don't think it changed a lot in the last 20 years or 40 years since I've been there. And there were beggars. Not like on State Street. Okay? But real beggars, you know, and people with leprosy. And blind people, lots of blind people. And just, you know, and they all dressed. It looked like, I felt like I went through a time warp. And I felt like it was like I was back in the days of Jesus. I actually it was just weird. And I just thought, gosh. Because everybody dressed like in robes and nobody had a suit. Everybody looked like they were straight off the street from a story Jesus was telling. And it was just overwhelming. It was really like I was in a different dimension. And I remember that night, Suzanne and I were sitting up on the mud balcony of our hotel room, which you would really laugh at. I don't even remember. I just remember standing out there, and there was some kind of tavern that was open, and it was noisy, and they were playing this crazy music, and somebody threw a melon out into the street, and a whole bunch of people came scrambling up and grabbed pieces of this melon and were stuffing their faces with it because they were hungry. And I thought, gosh. You know, in Namibia, I have people asking me for money on the streets all the time. And sometimes they're really hungry, and sometimes it's their job. And so you got to really be careful and watch it. You know, most of the time when the kids come up and ask us for money, we tell them to go home and go to school rather than giving them money, because I don't want to encourage them to grow up and develop a lifestyle of beggars. But they might be going home if they don't bring some money home or some food home. They might be going home and getting beaten. So it's really difficult. So I don't know if any of you have ever really lived with the poor, because it's different. It's like it's upsetting, and it's troubling. Because I have a nice house in Namibia. Taken me years to build it up and fix it up, and right now my son has just moved there. He's a cardiologist, and he's moved there. He's head of medicine and physiology at the brand new 2-year-old medical school. And we're fixing up his house, so he's got a nice house. But I've got people that work for me that live in the squatter camp. You know, and I have and the kids that at Community Hope School, they live in shacks. And some of you have seen the videos and see where they live, and you know, and you see it, but you don't smell it. And so smelling it really is different. We have one little boy at our school. He's in the 7th grade this year. His name is Lorenzo. And I had a guy come over, flew this guy over to do a video for the school, which didn't work out very well. But it at the end of the day, I visited a bunch of the kids' families because I wanted him to go and actually take pictures, because people tell me when they see my videos, the kids look all happy and healthy. They're at my school and they look great. Why should we send you money? These kids look fine. You know, so I need to show them what it's like at these kids' homes. So I don't go to the kids' homes. I have staff that I pay to go to the kids' homes. We go and we visit every home, but I don't, because I'm busy. Not that I never have or that I wouldn't. But I've got people that are better at it, and they actually speak the language, so it does a lot more good. So they figure out who's got a job, does anybody have a job, what are your needs, do the kids need a full scholarship or a partial scholarship. You know, a full scholarship is $50 a year. That's what it costs to go to our school if they're not going to pay. It costs us a lot more than $50 a year per kid. And I just think, you know, so I take this guy out to Lorenzo's home. And I forget why we went to Lorenzo's home. And he lives sort of in a compound. You go through this gate, it's the end of sort of a cul-de-sac in the street. You go and there's a bunch of shacks. And then there's a house. And there's people build shacks and they rent out the shacks to people that own the land. They have a house maybe that's made out of brick. And then they build a bunch of shacks and they rent out the shacks so that they can make a little money on their little tiny plot. It'd be like Craig and Jill having their nice home over here in Sun Prairie, and they build a bunch of shacks in back of the house so they can charge people rent to live there. Now, it would be cold in Wisconsin to live in a shack in the winter, and it's cold in Namibia because there's no heat at all. And I go in there, and it's a summer day, and it's hot, and Lorenzo's mother appeared to be fairly inebriated when I was there. And she was dirty, and there were flies buzzing all around her, and it smelled so bad. And I just thought, this kid, every day, he comes into the school, and he goes home to this. I just think, how does he cope? How does he deal with it? And I'm sure he loves his mom. And everybody was drunk. It wasn't just his mom, the whole, everybody, you know. So no wonder nobody's doing anywhere. And I just think, what a great thing to do, to give these kids an education. And I want to share some scriptures with you. It's two main points I want to talk about. One is the value of the individual. And this is why we have the school. Now, when we went to Namibia, we did not go to start a school. In fact, I decided not to start a school. I was intentionally not starting a school. Right, Suzanne? Right. And what was the first thing I had to do when I got there? I had to figure out a way for my kids to go to school, and I couldn't get them into any schools, and so I had to start a school for my own kids. So the first thing I did when I got to Namibia, I started a school. I thought, We didn't go to start a school. We went to train teachers to start schools and to help churches like Sun Prairie. And I don't know why you guys don't have school here. You should have a school here. You've got built. What happens to this building all week? It sits here. It's empty. Right. So, you know, I've got classrooms. There's no reason you shouldn't have a school here. So this is what I do to pastors when I go preach at their churches in Africa. I go, why don't you have a school here? I was in Zimbabwe once, and they woke me up on Sunday morning. They put me in the van. They said, on the way to church, they said, oh, by the way, you're preaching. I said, well, two can play this game. I spent the whole morning confronting them with the fact that they had a three-room church and they didn't have a grade 1 through 3 school there during the week. That's what I did. I'm not nice. If you surprise me in the morning on the way to church. And I just, you know, and so that's what I do. And so we were going to help and equip and motivate pastors to start schools in the poor communities for kids. They were going to do it, not me. I didn't want to, because running a school is a full-time job. It is a big job, and it's a lot of trouble. This is why pastors don't want to do it. I understand. I didn't want to do it. I had been working at a school, teaching at a school in Texas, and running a teacher training program, and I thought, boy, this is impossible to do both. So we're just going to focus on teacher training. And we did that for a few years, for about 5 years. And we had some great schools and trained some great teachers. And you know what? They all left. We train them, and they go back to Australia. They go back to Korea. Or they go back, or they go get jobs with the government. And I thought, you know. And then all of a sudden, the guy I work with, Brian Kinghorn, he said he turned over the Youth of the Mission base to another guy, and he didn't have a job now. He's just the national director. But he's, you know, YWAM Namibia has like got two bases. So being the national director means you don't, you know, there's not as much to do. So he and his wife started to pray, and they started to drive around and ask the Lord, what do you want us to do? Do you want us to go back to South Africa and retire, or do you want us to do something else? And God started speaking to him about AIDS orphans. Because in Namibia, 20% of the people have AIDS. It's 1 in 5. 30% of Africa's workforce is going to die in the next 10 years. That's a lot of dead people. Somebody asked me this morning about it, and I said, yeah, I can't tell you how many funerals I've paid for. And So this is sort of like, and they realized that if they weren't doing something about AIDS in Africa, they shouldn't be there. It's this pandemic. You know, we read about it, you hear about it, but it's really different when a lot of people have AIDS and a lot of people are dying of AIDS. And the orphans, there were, I forget, but there were like 50,000 orphans back in 1999. And the projection was there are going to be 250,000 orphans in Namibia by 2010. Now, there's only 2 million people in the country. That's a lot of orphans. We did a survey. So they decided to start this preschool and community center called Beautiful Gate at the time. Now we call it Beautiful Kids. The kids like that. They didn't know what was beautiful about the gate. They liked the Beautiful Kids bit. And they started this, and they got a bunch of kids, and they went out and did a survey in the community, and there were like 1,000 children in this five-block area. 200 of the 1,000 were orphans who were living with grandparents or aunts and uncles, and that's like one in five. There was a lot of orphans, you know, and so they realized they did demographics. They went to every house in the community and found out who were the poorest kids in the worst families in the community, and then they invited those kids into their preschool. And I think they had like 35 kids in that first class in the preschool. 20 of them had third stage tuberculosis. My son, when he went into the TB ward at the hospital, the Katatura Hospital, he just went, "My God, Dad, they don't even have any masks." He's been ordering masks. The administrator's he's just running into all this bureaucratic red tape. So, you know, he goes buys masks for people. He says, there's another pandemic of TB. There's so much tuberculosis, you know. And there's signs on cars that go by. It says, if you've been coughing for 6 weeks, you should go get a TB test. I think it's 3 weeks. So I cough all the time, so I get them all. I get TB tests all the time. It doesn't have anything to do with that. But it's just like this amazing sort of overwhelming need. And so about 3 years later, they got these kids that started in, you know, like 3-year-olds, 4-year-olds, 5-year-olds, and 6-year-olds, they're going to go to school. And Brian and Pam came to us, or we went to them. I forget how this happened. Did we go to them? Maybe. And we said, listen, these kids, we've been working with them. And I was on the board of directors for Beautiful Kids. And so I knew all about everything that we're doing, and we're buying the building and da-da-da-da-da, and just all this stuff that's going on. And these kids, and I'm watching these kids, and I go and I take my potter's wheel and I preach to them. I don't teach at the preschool. But I go and I'm working with them. We did a training seminars for their teachers, and really trying to help them learn how to teach English, because all these kids speak Damara. They don't speak English. They click. I can say one word in Damara. That means shut up and sit down. It's a really good word when you're working with kids. And so they laugh when I say it. They go, "Oh, Mr. Hunter, you're not supposed to say that." And so we went and we thought, what are we going to do? Here we've been trained. So we went to a couple who are still working with us today, Archie and Romy Bukas. And they had come back to Texas with us years before and done our teacher training program in Texas, our Teachers for the Nations program. And then Archie, we had helped start a school at a church. I had convinced some pastor to start a school about 8 hours north of us up in a little place called Onguadiva. And this was a YWAM guy, and he was also pastoring a church, a little four-square church. And they started a school, and Archie went up and helped start the school. It was great. And about a year later, they decided they wanted a different type of curriculum, so they did that, and Archie came back and got a job at another Christian school in a rich part of town called Highlands Christian School. And they used an American curriculum, which was sort of interesting. And Archie... We went to Archie and Romy, and we said, listen, we want to start a school, but we can't do it. We're too old. I said, and I'm not a trained teacher. I need a trained teacher. I need somebody who's qualified in Namibia that I can go to the government and I can apply to start a school, and they'll give us permission to start a school. And so they said, okay. They prayed about it, and they said, good. They're still with us today. Romy, today, is head of our family life ministries at the school. She's the one that organizes all the home visits, that makes sure the kid, the nutrition at the school is going well, that makes sure that the foods get bought, that if kids need counseling, she's the one that, with Suzanne, organizes counseling with them, for them. So she is like, I just watched Romy this year as she took this over. She's just like grown up and become fantastic. It's wonderful. It's like she's blossomed. And I thought, this is great. They've got three kids of their own. Last year, their oldest son, David, was going to graduate from grade 7 and go to high school. That's when you go to high school in Namibia. And they didn't know where they were going to send him. Here they've been having their own, you know, it's a little Christian school. I said, well, listen, I know the principal of the best school in town called St. Paul's College. It's a high school. Actually, it's grade 1 through 12. And they give a scholarship every year to one needy kid. He said, let's let David apply. So he did. He went and he applied and he got all the papers and he signed up. And then this pastor, the principal, he called me. He said, what? He said, you know this kid. I go, yes, I know this kid. I said, I know his parents. This is the kid. This is the kid you need in this school. They will be a blessing to your school. It was his last year there, and he pulled some strings for me. And now David is going to St. Paul's. And we just found out this year that our kids in grade 7 last year tested out at the same level that the St. Paul's kids tested out. The same level. We're like in the 80 percentile or 90 percentile of what our kids are testing out of, compared to the government average of about 30. And it's just wonderful to see what God's doing. And so the poor, working with the poor, caring for the poor. I want to share some scriptures with you, because this is something that I did not go to Namibia to work with the poor. I went to train teachers. That's what I like to do. And I don't care who you are. I don't care if you're rich. I don't care if you're poor. I like to train teachers. That's what I love. But I've begun to get to know some of these kids and their families, and visited some of their homes and just thought, why are you smiling? These kids come to school. I got these little kids, Whitney, Harold, and Presley, that come to school. Whitney's graduated now, and Harold and Presley, they come to school, and they're smiling. You wouldn't be smiling if you lived where they lived. You would not. You would be there for about a week, and you would figure out how to get out of there. You know what it is about being poor? I read a book about a guy who was a Catholic missionary in Ghana or something, and there was an Ebola breakout, and lots of people were dying, and he was taking care of people and so on and so forth, and he rode a bicycle, and he lived in a hut just like the people did and everything. He's from Belgium. And one day he said, why am I always still on the outside? He said, I'm just like you. And they said, no, you're not, Father. If you want to leave, you could leave. We can't leave. And that's what it means to be poor. You can't leave. You're stuck. You can't leave. You don't have the education. You don't have the background. You don't have the know-how. You're just poor. I was at a brickyard I was buying some bricks to put some pavers down in my son's yard. And I took my grandkids there, which is great. I got three grandkids, and the boys are standing up on top of the truck watching these guys load bricks into the back of the Vaki, in the back of the pickup. And I'm watching, and I'm just thinking, Because this brick company is owned by these Chinese people that are sort of taking over Namibia right now from communist China. There's lots of people. They don't even need a visa to come. They started all this business, and one of this is brick. So they make the cheapest bricks in all of Africa, and they sell them. It's like 65 Namibian cents. It's like under $1 per these little bricks. 65 cents, no. 10 cents a brick, which is cheap. It's really nice because the ones that the Germans make are about $3 a piece. So it's expensive. And so I'm talking to these two guys while they're loading bricks. I said, how much do they pay you? I always ask people this because it's funny. People don't mind telling you there because it's weird. You don't ask people here, how much do you make? But I ask everybody because I'm sort of interested in the economy and how much do tellers make at the grocery store? How much do, people that work as an accountant at a hardware store, I ask people what they make. And these guys, I say, what do they make? And they said, we make 40 Namibian dollars a day. The dollar right now is 9 to 1. That's less than $5 a day. Now, they buy food at the same place as I buy food. I can't live on $5 a day. I have no idea how they support families on $5 a day. But they're still working there. You know why they're working there? Because there's a 60% unemployment rate in Namibia. And so these people are being robbed, even though they've got jobs. Their employers are oppressing them, and they're robbing them, and keeping them poor. And they're glad to have a job because they didn't working for $40 a day, they wouldn't be working. There's all sorts of people on the streets waiting for jobs. I stopped the other day, I was driving, and I was dropping somebody off, and I stopped in front of one of these places where there's all these guys in these blue worker outfits, and they're standing on the side of the road, and I stopped to let this guy out or to check my phone or something, and all of a sudden, the whole back of my truck is full of people. They all jumped into the back of my truck. All these guys in these blue worker outfits, and I went, whoa! We both, this girl and I that were sitting in the car, she's one of my teachers, we went, whoa! I went, oh. Well, I had to get out, and I said, no, I'm just stopping. I don't need any help. Everybody wants a job. You just pick up people, you pay them $40 a day, pay them $5 a day. When's the last time you worked for $5 a day? I think I was 5. I don't think I got paid that much. Poverty is a problem. And and Namibia has the biggest gap between rich and poor of any country in the world. There's lots of really rich people. So I ought to be able to get all the money I need to run the school there. But I've noticed rich people aren't generous. That's why I ask poor people like you for money. It's true. It's true. The value of the individual. People are worth something. It says, a guy named Frothingham said that man was created in the image of God, in the divine image, destined for immortality. Pronouncing that in the eye of God, all men are equal. All men are equal. In God's eyes, we're all the same. There's not rich or poor, man or woman, slave or free. We're all the same to God. We're all sinners, and we all need to be saved. We have all fallen short. And, Namibia and Southern Africa has been under apartheid, a segregation, racism thing based on a Bible doctrine that the Dutch Reformed Church, the Reformed Churches, decided that the blacks were not elected by God. And therefore, they weren't really human. And therefore, yes. And they had all sorts of justification for this. Then they used the Bible to develop a segregation policy and to protect themselves against the black majority. They used the Bible. You can understand why people have trouble with Christianity. And as we've been training teachers and working with kids, what I see happening is these kids, we tell them that they're valuable to God. And that Frothingham calls this idea that all men are equal is the central doctrine of Christianity. It's at the center. It's at the core. And that's what we base all of our teaching on. Everything. Because I tell my teachers, I said, you are not more important or more valuable than the students you're teaching. You are here to serve them. That's the whole servant vessel thing. You're here to serve them. He who is greatest among you is what? Servant of all. That's what God wants us to be. He wants us to serve. He wants to show people how valuable they are. Leave it to the preacher to not turn his phone off. I've done that. Sometimes when I'm preaching, I leave my phone on because I'm in a different country and my wife calls me and I need to take the call. The kingdom of heaven is like a treasure hidden in a field, Matthew 13:44. That a man found and hid, and from joy over it went and sold all that he had and bought the field. All that he had. Then he goes and he tells the parable. Jesus tells the parable of the pearl of great price, and it's the merchant that goes and sells all that he had. And then there's the dragnet, and they go out into the boats, and they throw their nets out, and they pull it in, and they separate the good fish from the bad fish. And this is about us being our value. The scripture is about our value, that Jesus went and he gave up everything. Jesus is the man that went and found the treasure in the field. And you know what the treasure is? You are the treasure. You are the treasure to God. Now, I have 5 kids and 11 grandchildren. And I have 3 grandchildren that live next to me now in Namibia. My son got so tired of being away from us, he finally just graduated from cardiology, whatever, and moved to Africa. Boom! Didn't think about it, just did it. And it's just hilarious. Our nice little quiet life has gone away. I have screaming grandchildren at the table almost every night at dinner. Sometimes we say, we're going to eat by ourselves tonight. But it's wonderful. And these kids, and my kids, you know, they're so important to me. They're so wonderful. I have so much love for them and compassion, no matter what kind of a mess their lives are or how dirty they get, I still love them. In fact, I like them. I like to hang out with them. And that's how God feels about it. How much is one of your grandchildren, one of your children, your husband, your wife, how much are they worth to you? That's how God feels about us. Is there a monetary value? Jesus said here, he says, a man found and hid the treasure and from joy over it, and he went and he sold some of the things that he had and bought the field. No, he sold all that he had. Jesus bought the field, and you were in it. He bought the whole field, so that he could have you. And I do a whole series about the potter's field, and the clay in the potter's field is that treasure, and God can take it and rework our lives and make it into something beautiful. A few weeks ago, I was reading the book of Jeremiah. I try to read my Bible about once a month. I'm glad the missionaries are laughing this morning. And because I know I need to, so I fix breakfast and I sit down at the table and I get my Bible and I eat and read my Bible. My wife's already gone to school and she said, come to school, John. I go, okay, I'll be there. And I was reading in Jeremiah and I just opened my Bible and I was reading and God, Jeremiah is talking about Jehoiakim, who's a bad king, Josiah's son. He's a bad guy, and if you know anything about the timeline and so on and so forth, it's right before Nebuchadnezzar comes down and nukes Jerusalem. It's like the last guy just before the end comes. And he's going on about how bad he is. And he said, now let me tell you about your dad. This is Josiah. He was a good guy. Loved God with all of his heart. And he said this about Josiah. He said, he judged the cause of the poor and needy. Now, what's that mean? It means he defended them. He defended the poor and needy. Doesn't mean he judged them like we think, oh, I'm judging you because you smoke cigarettes. That's not what he's talking about. Talking about he defended their cases. In other words, when somebody was going to oppress them, he stood in the gap and spoke for them. Jeremiah 22:16. Then it was well with him. Because he did this, he had a good life. Was not this to know me? And I went, ooh, was not this to know me? Is not this to know me? That's a pretty amazing thing to say. I thought, you know, what's it mean to know God? Well, you know, we go to church and we worship God and you do this and you do that. But this is not, that God says, defend the cause of the poor and needy. That's what it means to know me. From God's own lips. And I thought, well, no wonder things are going so well with me. It's true. It's really true. My wife said not to say this, but you know what? Since we started this school, we haven't needed any money for the school. I probably don't need to fundraise. I don't know why. Ever since I started the school, the money has just poured in for the school. Now, I'm going to ask you for money for the school to sponsor kids because that's how it comes in. But, and you know why? Because God will bless you if you do it. It's really amazing. Since we started this school, we have never, ever had the bank account be empty. I've never had to go to the staff and say, I can't pay you this month. And I've been thinking about this. This school, because I am not like Mr. Faith. I have guys in YWAM, they're believing God for ocean liners to start hospitals that sail around the world at $50,000 a day. I am not there. I'm not one of those guys. I really am not. I am John. And I work hard for my money. I make pottery, come over and sell it. You know? And I just think, we started this school and we knew God wanted us to do this. And I didn't want to do it. But I did it anyway. And first year, I think somebody gave us 50 grand. I went, oh, well, this is good. That was the whole budget for the whole year. I was just like, wow, that was wonderful. I think it was 20 grand the first time. It was just miracle after miracle. One day, I was in Dallas, and I made a pot after the preacher preached. And a guy came up. It was 50,000, wasn't it? How much was that? 25,000. Guy came up, and he said, I'd like to give you $25 for that pot, is what I thought he said to me. And I said, you know, I got some outside, and they cost a little more than that, but buy one of those. This is just raw clay. He said, no, I want that, and I want to show it. I want to show that to my foundation. I thought, oh, I started to listen to him. He said, and you can give the $25,000 to the charity of your choice. Now, Suzanne thinks she's a charity, but she didn't get the money. I'm a charity case. And the money, and that was just wonderful. You know, and it's like, now I tell people, they say, well, how much is your body? You know, how much is something worth? How much is something worth? I don't sell my pottery for $25,000. But this guy bought one of my pots for $25,000. That puts me in a whole different ball game. When artists say, well, how much do you sell your work for? I go, well, you know, usually about 25 grand. They go, oh, you know. I mean, you got to be somebody, right? You got to be somebody special. You got to sell your stuff for that much. Well, that's Jesus gave everything for you, your value. He didn't pay the market value for you. Let me tell you that. He knew what you were worth. I heard of a guy the other day that bought a bowl for $3 at a thrift store. It turned out to be a Ming Dynasty bowl. It was worth $250,000. What? The difference is, God knows your value. And these kids at school, I tell people, I said, you know what? I'm going to give these children at Community Hope School as good an education as my own children got. That's my goal. I don't know if I can do better than that. That's pretty good. I'm pretty happy with the way these kids, their education. The motto of Community Hope School is to know God. YWAM, to know God and make him known. In 1643, Harvard College wrote this in their first fruit. Said, let every student be plainly instructed and earnestly pressed to consider well. The main end of his life and studies is to know God. That's the purpose of education. That's why I started this school. These kids can know God. And so that they can know God better, we have started an outreach program for our kids. We are going to take them and visit the poor. We're going to find people that are poorer than them and sicker than them. And we're going to take our kids out and we're going to do good to them. We're going to go take our kids and we're going to go paint their houses. These are the poor kids doing this because I want them to know God too. You don't get to know God unless you learn how to give. It isn't going to happen. In fact, it's so important that we take care of the poor that in 1 John 3:17, he says, John says, but whoever has this world's goods, material possessions, and sees his brother in need and shuts up his heart and does not have pity on him, how does the love of God abide in him? It's a sign to the world that we are Christians, that we've been converted, that we're not living for ourselves. I remember in Afghanistan when I was cleaning the toilet when my wife had hepatitis, the Lord spoke to me really clearly. It's before I got saved. He said to me, he said, John, you're selfish. It was very convincing the way he said it because I realized it was true. Even cleaning the toilet. I was doing it for selfish motives. And God can set us free from that. God can set us free from ourselves. He can change us. God can change you. He really can. And evidence of that change, Jesus says in the parable of the Good Samaritan, says the Samaritan, he goes and he takes the guy, you know, his friends come by, the Jewish people come by, and they don't take care of him. And then this Samaritan comes by, and this guy that's on the road is a Jew, and he's his enemy. But he picks him up, and he takes him to the inn, and he tells the innkeeper, he says, you know, anything he needs, put it on my bill. Does he know this guy? Is he his friend? Not his friend. Who is your neighbor? They're not your best friends down the street. And then Jesus says at the end of that parable, he says, go and do likewise. Go and do likewise. I think it's really exciting. You guys are starting this garden. I'm glad this whole sermon series turned out into something practical. That's really good. It's wonderful that there's an expression. You know, Craig likes gardens, you know, and I think he thinks everybody else likes gardens, but And it's been going on for a long time. He started this garden thing in October when I was here, you know. I'm thinking, boy, he's still into it. Finally finished. The garden thing. But now you guys are going to have a garden, and you're going to do something really wonderful. You're going to go out and you're going to feed people that need food. I'm going to give you a list of people I know that are hungry. Little hunter kids running around Madison. Deuteronomy 15, 7 and 8 says, if there's a poor man, be open-handed and give him whatever he needs. Not some brand new teaching. Galatians says, be good to all men. Not just the family of faith, but especially the family of faith. Yeah, if your brother has need, but don't just limit to the church. Let's go out and find people that don't deserve to be blessed, and let's bless them. And the reason is because if we take care of people, people will sit up and notice. The world will notice. Emperor Julian, the last emperor of Rome, said this. He said, do we not observe how the benevolence of Christians to strangers has done the most to advance their cause? It is disgraceful that the Christians support not only their poor, but ours as well. Well, everyone is able to see that our own people lack aid from us. The emperor of Rome noticed that the Christians were taking care of the poor. And he was embarrassed. And that he said, that's what's done more to aid their cause. You know, we like to talk about Jesus. But God has called us to be a kingdom of priests. And priests stand in the gap and take care of people's needs. Not a kingdom of prophets telling everybody what they've done wrong. We're not called to be a kingdom of prophets. We're called to be a kingdom of priests. And the job of the priest was to make sure, was to distribute the tithes and offerings that came in to the poor. That's what God has called us to do. Why do we do it? You don't do it because out of guilt. You don't do it because, oh, if I don't do this, God won't love me. You do it out of obedience because you love him. Paul says, the love of Christ controls me. You know, our motivation is of going out and doing good isn't because other people will look at us and notice us. You know, that was the Pharisees. They went to the main part of town, rang a bell, and then gave alms to the poor. That is not what this is about, you know. It's about doing it because it's the right thing to do because it pleases God. And God has changed me. And I really didn't try. I didn't try. I just started this school because it was the right thing to do. This one little girl named Independencia at our school. What's she in the third grade now? So I really like her name. She's born on March 21st, which is July 4th in Namibia. It's our Independence Day. And I just started making a big fuss about her because I love her name. And so now she loves me. Every day I come to school, she stops what she's doing. She'd be out on the playground, and she stops, and she sees me. I get out of my car. She runs over, and she gives me this big hug because she knows I think she's pretty cool. I think she's special because I always go in. And you know what's funny? It was my birthday in March, and I got all these birthday cards from a bunch of kids, and I got a whole slew of them from third graders. And one of her friends wrote to me, I think her name was Crystalline, and I don't even remember this girl's name. which is terrible, I'm sure, but there's 120 kids in the school. And this little girl, she wrote me, she said, "You know me, I'm Independencia's friend." And I thought, whoa, you know, isn't they all know, all the kids know, she's my favorite. It's okay. Because you know what? That makes them feel special too. Because they know I love Independencia. Not that I don't love them. I just, you know, I teach America's Christian history and all this stuff. So I love America and I love July 4th. I love Independence Day. And I love what it, the whole idea of the freedoms that our Constitution has brought us here in America. That we can, you know, we have a four-page document that defines what it means to be a Christian nation. And we can do that. We can take that freedom, that liberty, into the whole world. And the way we do it is by taking care of the poor and the needy.